I am a church historian, teaching in a fairly diverse urban theological school in Chicago. I'm a minister in the United Church of Christ. My seminary is a seminary of the United Church of Christ. And partly, I think, because of my vocation of being a church historian, trying to figure out of what use the memories of the church are, I've become very intrigued by the concept of tradition. And I'm kind of on a personal crusade to redefine and expand our understanding of what this might mean. Hi. We live in a time in which criticisms of tradition are very widespread and vocal. Do you agree with that? Do you experience that when you come to Holden? I was here last week, and I noticed that a lot of people seem to be nervous about the kinds of criticisms which were being brought against the tradition. It was patriarchal. It was heterosexist. It was hierarchical. It was violent. Okay. And in this context of criticism, there are a variety of responses. One response that's very vocal, I think, on the national scene at least, is kind of the Christian tradition, love it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Another response is often to choose to continue one's spiritual pilgrimage outside of the Christian tradition. There are people who, in the course of critiquing Christian tradition, decide that they cannot find life there, and they continue it outside. But for a lot of us, I guess including myself, there's something else that needs to take place. The criticism seems to be valid and seems to be worth struggling with, and yet there's this desire to belong to a community where Eucharist is celebrated. Okay? There's this treasuring of our own baptism, of our own belief, our own relationship with God and Christ. And in that, it's in that spirit that I'm trying to find ways of rethinking what it means to belong to a tradition, to find ourselves within a certain historical community, in our case, the church, and how that is a life-giving thing. And it seems to me that some historical perspective on the time of change in which we find ourselves might help us to live graciously and gracefully through this time of change. So what I want to do in this session, first of all, is to explain, open up the concept of tradition as a living tradition, okay, and then to have some conversation about some of the challenges to tradition which we find ourselves living in the midst of, and how we can address this question of whether criticizing the tradition must lead to its destruction. Now I want to start with a story. This is from a novel some of you may have read called Giants in the Earth by Ole Rovag. A novel written in the 1920s, at which time Rovag was professor of Norwegian literature at St. Olaf's College. He was himself born in Norway, emigrated with so many of that generation in the late 19th century to South Dakota, and became an interpreter of that immigrant experience and its spiritual meaning. And in this novel, this is the story of several families of immigrants from Norway to North Dakota in this case. And by the point we get to in the novel that I'm going to read from, there's this small community of people who by this time, here you see, have developed complex relationships among themselves. They stand in need of forgiveness and reconciliation one with another. They carry certain burdens and stories with them. They've been living out on the prairie in sod huts. And some of them see this as the land of opportunity. Others see it as a threatening place godforsaken. And at this point, a stranger rides into their little settlement of sod huts and doesn't identify himself at first, but we soon learn that he's the minister. And he's a Norwegian Lutheran missionary sent to this community who's seeking out the people. And he instructs some of them that this afternoon, call your neighbors, we'll gather in the largest house and have a worship service. And this is what happens at that point. Just a description of their service. The minister stood in the corner next to the window, arrayed in full canonicals. The gown was threadbare and badly wrinkled as a result of its many journeys inside the old valise. The ruff might have been whiter, perhaps, but such trifles were not noticed now, for here stood a real Norwegian minister in ruff and robe. It was undoubtedly true what Ton Satan had said about him. He was an altogether remarkable man. The vestments which he wore seemed only to emphasize the strength of his features, whose youthful vigor, in spite of the gray-streaked beard, appeared at this solemn moment to have taken on a new glow of life. The table, spread with a white cloth, had been placed so close to the window that the minister barely had space to stand behind it. On the table stood two homemade candles, one at either end. The candlesticks, too, were homemade, cut from 2 4-inch pieces of sapling with the bark left on and painted white. At a little distance, they looked like curious works of art. The candles were not yet lighted. A Bible and a hymn book lay between them. Now, as I hear this passage, there's a longing for that which was familiar in the old country. You hear that? And there's a sense that they want the table to be spread in a certain way, that it's, how is he dressed? A real Norwegian minister, right? That there is a familiarity, there's a yearning for the old, the past, the roots. And in that sense, it shows their longing for tradition as a conservative thing. And they're looking to the way it was in Norway. That's what they want. They probably wouldn't want to change one thing. Okay. So in one sense, this is a conservative event. In another sense, it's through that yearning and through this, in this new place, that a new community is going to be founded, okay, which introduces that old Norwegian Lutheran heritage into a new society, where it will be transformed by that society, right? Where it will continue to grow, where it will get mixed up with American values, okay? Where it will ultimately merge with the Danes and then the Swedes and then the Germans and then finally even enter a World Council of Churches where there's a sense of a global church. Okay, that's several mergers ago now, right? And there are probably some grandchildren of those people, if they weren't fictional. You know, oops, that's all right. I think it's just on my papers, which I don't need. There are probably some grandchildren of those people at Holden Village today, right? As a result of this conservative event. You cannot stop a living tradition from growing into the future. You put it in a new place, and it grows and on into the future, even though it may have begun with a conservative yearning. Okay? And Lutheranism itself is changed as a result of that little community of Norwegians looking back to Norway. It's introduced into a new place, and it takes off. Now, Luther said, among many other things, that we must do our believing as we must do our dying alone. And there's a certain sense in which, thank you, Bill. I forgot this was here. Just gesturing and all that. There's a certain sense in which I think that's existentially true, and that there's a certain faith dimension which is one's own. However, it seems to me very clear, and this is, I think, something which a lot of forms of social thought are addressing now, that we don't come into who we are alone. Right? We can't, we need language, which we learn from speaking with others. We become spiritual in a certain way by what we see in others, by our relationships with others. Okay? That there is no such thing as a Christianity or any other form of religion, which is not in some way born in a specific kind of community. And many of the particularities of this little, if we imagine this little Norwegian Lutheran community on the Great Plains, ties into, sure, a worldwide sense of Christianity, but it's a very particular little way. It's not like every other form of Christianity. It had its own little approach, right, to the tradition. And it's in that particularity that whatever promise Christian faith has was first encountered by those people, and most of us encountered Christianity in some other particular form also, right? Some community, which is very particular. Now, to get at some of the features of this, I want to go four pages on in the novel and read one more paragraph, which is later on in the same worship service. The minister, in the intervening pages, preaches to the people about the story of Exodus and about the Israelites going into a new land. And he tells them that they face the same kind of dilemma that the Israelites faced. Would they choose life or choose death? Would they be like the faithful tribes or the 10 who were lost but never heard from again? So he's helping them to put their experience, which is very particular, into a much longer story. The people sat and stood about while he was preaching, hanging on every word he said. Only a few were competent to climb the ladder of reasoning that he had raised for them. The others realized that he was preaching well and let it go at that. It gave them a simple satisfaction just to listen. They rejoiced in their hearts that such a man had come here today. They felt that he wished them well. And it was so fine and jolly, too, this gathering together. Now there would be some excitement in the settlement. One was thinking about the congregation that they would have to organize, another about the location of the new church, still another about the cemetery as to where it would probably be located. And to everyone the thought came that men would be needed to manage these activities. Well, they would show him that they could govern themselves, that they were a well-conducted people. One woman had it in mind that they would, of course, start a ladies' aid, now that they had a minister. And that would be great fun, with meetings and cakes and coffee and sewing and all the rest. She proposed to begin some embroidering at once. But those who had not yet been confirmed dreaded the ordeal a little, though at the same time they were glad. At any rate, there would be a change in the daily monotony, and they would, of course, have some fine new clothes for the confirmation. Okay. Now, what I hear in this paragraph is a sense of the social quality of their congregation. I mean, believe me, in the novel, I mean, there are deep things of repentance and transformation going on, but it's within this social form, right? And they know just what it's supposed to be like. And also that it's transgenerational. They're thinking about the cemetery. They're thinking about confirmation. Right? There's something going on here which they believe they can see generations into the future when they think about this. And they can think about their own past as well. Right? What these people think of when they think of church is not exactly the same thing as other people would think of when they think of church in other parts of the world. Right? They're the ladies' aid is a form that emerges at certain points. Right? The church council. Churches haven't always had church councils. But they have a certain social form for this. My wet pages here. Now, let me stop for a minute and ask if you hear things in this which I haven't lifted up, and how it sounds to you. Reactionary, smug, sentimental. I mean, any comments about this little church on the prairie that I'm trying to evoke? Anything you hear in it that I haven't yet lifted up?
Mm-hmm. I understand very well their excitement, because it must have been a very dull life of them. I don't know, but here comes something else that transcends their lives and make it come into a very a bigger context. It's not only the daily chores, it's something bigger and tradition, okay, but this is something that is more than tradition, and the community between them will be bigger also because of this. And it's hard to, in that particular context, to speak about conservatism. I also understand their deep,
Yearning.
I'm Swedish.
What's happened?
And what it means, especially for people who might not have been there very long. I see it very
positive. I like this term, the larger context. It places their experience in a larger context. And in this passage, the larger context is the story of the Old Testament. I mean, that context becomes their context. Right. Any other comments? Now, even as these people are planning their little church with the church council, the ladies' aid, and so on, and it sounds very... I mean, it could seem very parochial. It is parochial. It is what they wanted from their Norwegian town. Okay? But within this, even within this paragraph, there are clues to the conflict and the diversity of tradition out of which they come. Okay? That it's not a static thing. The easiest example is Luther's protest itself, okay? Which founded the branch of the tradition in which these people exist, and which, believe me, was deeply shaking to the people who lived through it, and which redefined the nature of the way in which we ought to go about seeking our salvation for the people who lived through it. That Luther's own protest sought to reform the way in which people worshipped, who could be the character of the ministry, the married clergy, the clergy who were not as segregated from the life of the common people, the priesthood of all believers, taking away many forms that were familiar, like certain kinds of religious pilgrimages, relics, forms of popular devotion which people were very attached to, veneration of the Virgin Mary and the saints. Okay. That within this now smug little congregation, there's a history of protest embedded under the surface.
But one shouldn't forget that the Lutheran Church in the Scandinavian countries is an institution and is representing, I don't know the English word for it, but the same as the king and the government and everything. And that these people coming to America, maybe they wanted to liberate themselves from a little of that. And if a priest is coming now, a pastor from Norway, he might think that he should represent again this power over the people there and, and tell them what to do. And I don't think they would like that anymore, probably. They wasn't that... There is something about govern ourselves,
and there's a whole this is helpful. I mean, there is conflict built into the situation. That's all I'm trying to say, is that within every stage of Christian history there is conflict built into the situation. So I think you're coming that this clue, we will show them we can govern ourselves, is interesting. I mean, and there's a whole history of lay struggle for lay power within the church these people come from, which is hinted at there. The idea of the Ladies' Aid Society. I mean, there was a time when that, probably about 150 years before this passage, when that was a new and unsettling idea to people, to have the women meeting by themselves, talking about religion and trying to accomplish things. And in retrospect, it seems like we take it for granted, but each one of these stages, I think, represents an unfolding of tradition. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you can see hints of the pietistic movement in here, too, throughout the book, in which really shaped the Christian world in about the 1700s, in which some of the hierarchical structures of the church and the modes of worship and the forms of preaching were taken to be alienated from, not appropriate to, the real deep spiritual life that the people sought. And so they formed themselves into small groups, learned how to pray on their own, and were criticized for corrupting the doctrine which the university-educated clergy wished to hold themselves. What I'm trying to get at is the way in which the change is built into life within Christian tradition. Okay, there's always a river, in a sense, of change flowing from the past towards the future, and that these people whose form sounds conservative at that point will ultimately go through the kinds of changes which will lead some of their descendants to be at Holden Village doing things in a different way. Tradition, I think of tradition as something which is passed along through social forms, okay, into which one enters, which runs across time and space. So in other words, from the past into the future, but also there are people sharing in the tradition in different continents from ours. Right? Something which is expansive in time and space. And something which embodies conflict and change within itself. Right? That's part of the ongoing process of living in Christian tradition. And that what we receive and what we pass on is tradition, but there's always that opportunity for each generation to leave its imprint on the ongoing tradition. This happens in every generation, sometimes by the highlighting of a new element, sometimes by bringing Christian faith into a new context. There are in Asia, for instance, it's exciting to people there to celebrate communion with rice at the center rather than bread. And this is a sign of living tradition, not of abandonment of tradition, as I would see it. Now let me stop and ask, this could go anywhere. Talk about some of the things that might be happening now which are challenging tradition. And some of the, just raise some of the kinds of criticisms that are taking place and some of the ways in which our generation may be called upon to leave an imprint on tradition as we pass it on. Got a couple people over. Mm-hmm.
The large number of divorces within the church, within the clergy, has certainly questioned tradition.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm currently a member of a Presbyterian church, and you've probably been following us in the newspapers.
Right. Right.
And one of the things that they do is the Presbyterians are best at is to form committees and study groups and task forces to go back and rake over the things that are of great import at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And 30 years ago it was relatively boring compared to what we're doing now. But one of the things that has come out of the system as a recent proclamation that they're going to include in the canons as the 11th element of the canons, that all people, both genders, all races, are all made in the image of God,
mm-hmm.
and that is supposedly going to address the issue of paternalism, at least up to the point where all this can be undone in future, because women have been ordained as ministers in the church since the 50s, but it still hasn't kind of taken root. And so what this does, basically, it's sort of the ERA that has come to pass to sweep out the closet.
Mm-hmm.
Because logically, or from other statements, it's been put in piecemeal, but not in a sweeping manner. And starting at that point in the development, then presumably the next generation will be able to digest mm-hmm. from that point in the Reformed tradition mm-hmm. and go on mm-hmm. from there.
Mm-hmm.
Half of the elders and half of the deacons in our church are women, or our congregation mm-hmm. are women.
Okay. Which was not even legal until 1930 in that church, and more recently in many other churches, and still not in some churches. These are helpful comments. I think that the idea of the social embodiment of change, as well as the proclamation of change, is part of the concept of tradition that I'm trying to work with. Okay, the way in which things become part of the lives of people and become part of the way in which churches organize themselves is, you know, as well as the statements, the way in which those things go together is part of this concept.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like we're really talking about the evolution of tradition. And yet if something has evolved, it's not the same anymore. So is it really tradition anymore?
A lot of what we were looking at in the task forces were there's so much said mm-hmm. in any document in the Bible or the American mm-hmm. Constitution or anything else that people seem to be able to somehow misconstrue or interpret things in a certain way. And one of the people I talked to a woman who's a theologian in another Presbyterian church in town rakes it all the way down to the original Greek. She's a scholar mm-hmm. and she talks about set instruction, all the rest of it, and she talks a lot about the conflicts or apparent conflicts between this passage and that passage.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are things there that are gray, that don't make sense. There are holes, there are blank spots. You have to fill in the blanks, and you have to decide in which one of 12 ways you can execute a policy based on all this sort of thing. And that's why it's with this Reformed Church, because mm-hmm. they'll look at it over the generations.
We could come up with so many examples. Let me try. I think a question that often comes up is what needs to not be lost? Is that true? I mean, what is it that, and perhaps that's what we should try to turn to. Really, when I'm trying to put this into non-technical language, but I'm really working with ideas raised by a philosopher by the name of Alastair MacIntyre, who writes about tradition as a living thing, not as that which we simply receive, but that within which we stand and are shaped and which we will reshape on the way into the future. Okay, and he talks about it being socially embodied, including conflict, and being historically extended through time. But one of the key ideas here is that a tradition is what he calls an argument, okay, about the goods which are at its center. Okay, an argument about the goods which are at its center. So you're not passing on something inviolate, but you're having an ongoing argument about the goods which are at the center. And I will hazard a proposal about the goods which are at the center, okay, over which we can argue, which would be within Christian tradition, argument over, and he can speak of tradition as, for instance, the tradition of the university is to always be arguing about what a good university is, okay, the tradition of farming,
always be arguing about what good farming is. Okay? The tradition of Christianity, always be arguing about what Christianity is. And to be on a quest to discover the full meaning of what that is and what it may yet be, if it's a living tradition. To a quest to discover the full meaning of what that is and what it may yet be. Okay? What? So the goods at the center of the tradition is what we would need to get at. What are the goods at the center? I would propose that the goods at the center would be the belief that God is decisively disclosed and been argued about, socially embodied in community through time. Does this, okay, now this is different from saying that the tradition equals the Bible, okay? Or that the tradition equals the canon, a certain canon or a certain structure. Okay? But that the Christian tradition consists of those people who are, through time, discussing and on a quest to discover further what the meaning, the full meaning, and the meaning as it may yet be, of Jesus Christ, of that Jesus event is. Does that, anyone want to dispute that or try a better way? McIntyre isn't writing about Christian faith, he's writing about tradition, so I'm plugging this in myself. And that would be a proposal. Then you can find within the Christian tradition, capital T, as the World Council of Churches says, many different traditions which go about that in a different way.
But does that mean you're in the tradition if you engage in the argument and claim the opposite, that Jesus Christ wasn't the full disclosure, you're now in the tradition?
I would say so. I mean, if you still really care about and are impelled to be part of that conversation.
So if you're engaged, you're in it.
I would say so. I'll take disputes, but...
Heretics are included.
Yes, and the tradition, the other thing is you can never tell who the heretic is at this time, right? I mean, if you were on the scene in 1415, the people who were proposing the things which Luther would soon enact were being burned at the stake. You can't tell who's a heretic at the moment. The winners declare who the heretics were in retrospect, okay? So that's one reason I like tradition as a living concept that's always still going on, compared to if you trace it just from, say, apostolic succession, you know, or some other way of understanding the unity across time, mm-hmm. the people. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, when you're talking about this is really basic. I mean, mm-hmm. The other kinds of traditions that you have exposed, the way you spread the altar and the rest of it, those are much more surface kinds of things. But sometimes those are more important to people, because of the detail or because of the familiarity. But when you really get down to, it's like we were up here before, but now we're talking about the Jesus Act. We're talking way down here, basically.
Okay. Does everybody get the? Yeah. Well, let's ask: are they? They are different at one level, but would we know about the deep one without the ladies who spread the altar cloths when we were little kids? Or, would we? Aren't there points of entrance into this discovery of the meaning of Jesus Christ for the world, whatever it may yet prove to be? Is that fair, or okay? Let me give you one more piece of McIntyre's theory of tradition. He argues that, so that there's a real treasuring here of social embodiment. That it's not just ideas that get passed
down, like a creed that gets passed down. There's a real treasuring of the way in which life together in community over time keeps the gospel alive. And he would say the goods of the tradition, but I'm using it for a Christian. And he argues that there are, that each tradition, farming, universities, medicine, Christianity, whatever, is transmitted as people engage in the practices which are intrinsic to that tradition. There are practices, there are things that Christians have done in almost everywhere, and some practices fall out of use for a while, but they come back, they're part of the heritage. One church might let them drop, another might let them, might bring them back to life. Okay? That through the, it's through engaging in the practices that you learn to enter the tradition and to discover, to be on your quest of what Jesus Christ might mean, has meant, does mean, will mean. Okay? Christian practice, I'll name a couple, you can start to add. Things like prayer, okay? Worship, care of the poor or sick, the whole part of the tradition that comes from the prophets and the gospels, justice making, others. How do we govern ourselves? Doing theology, writing theology books, that's a whole practice which keeps the tradition alive. Writing and doing theology. I had about a dozen. Are there others you would want to add? That together, they're practices that you learn to do from other members of the tradition, the doing of which keeps you active in participating in and transforming and furthering the tradition in a new place. I can look at my sheet. Do you have any other ideas that you would put up here?
My response to this is your argument about the central goods and looking at practices. I'm sitting there and thinking, well, how would I know the different, Jews as well as Christians do all those things and practices, but we think that there's something different in the central body, so that their tradition ends up, we think, in a different place than ours, but we get down to the individual practices, we get to see, well, they do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are a lot of historical interactions between those traditions.
I just don't know enough about other major religions to make comparisons with.
Another one I should probably put here is text study, which would make some of the difference, which texts you study.
But still you're engaged in text study for your...
Right. Well, and there probably are a lot of similarities. My hunch is that that if we fill these out completely, and let's say we included, sharing the gospel or some term for evangelism or something like that, that if we got a complete list of practices in which some Christians have always been engaged at each point in time, you could say, that we would come up with a list which was uniquely Christian, but that many of them would be shared with others, with other traditions. But the point here is to stop thinking of tradition as something which is handed down, never to change, and to begin thinking of it as something in which you participate, and in which it's very difficult to participate. You can't participate without participation in the life of social groups that keep the practices alive.
go ahead, Jeff.
It seems like one of the things that you might be saying is that for someone to claim to be a Christian, this is the list of things that you have to somehow reckon with. These are the questions that you have to somehow talk about. This is the language that you have to somehow either use or decide not to use. But you have to make that choice. The example with the Asian church is really significant.
Right.
The fact that they chose rice instead of bread, they had to wrestle with the Eucharist and that tradition. But the bread was not important, even though that's the kind of traditional element. It's that discussion that they had.
Right. But as you put sacraments up here, too.
I
think that is helpful. Yeah. Something like that. I think that also that the Christian tradition as a whole includes a lot of diversity on each of these things, each one of these practices. I mean, there have been many, many different ways of praying. And we think of just the one way that we're used to. But within the history of the church and within the world church, there are a lot of options on each of these. You're right that I think these are the things that that people are presented with, mm-hmm. in a sense. And I mean them as actions that they engage in, not just as ideas. These are the things that people are engaged in. But they're all things that you can't learn by yourself, too. They're part of the ongoing life of communities. You can't learn them by yourself. And moreover, I would say that the practices support one another. That your text study will be richer if you're involved in the other practices. You know, that your worship will be richer if you're also involved in the other things. That they are mutually supporting, and that just any one of them is not by itself can't carry the whole.
I think one of the real problems happens, and you alluded to this earlier. I think it would be hard to argue about this. Mm-hmm. Because we all worship, we all mm-hmm. care, we all pray, we all are justice makers, kind of mm-hmm. in the abstract general mm-hmm. sense. But whether or not we use LBW setting 1, 2, or 3, every Sunday of the year, or have Eucharist once a Sunday, or mm-hmm. or once a month, or once a quarter, those are the arguments that decide whether or not we're Lutheran, or we're Methodist, mm-hmm. or we're Christian, or... I'm not saying that's true, but that's sometimes kind of the passion mm-hmm. that we bring to all of these discussions. Mm-hmm. The big question, I think, for Lutheran Christians on the West Coast, or at least for many of us who live in San Francisco and California, is what is it about our tradition that makes us at all significant mm-hmm. in the spirituality dialogue which is happening mm-hmm. kind of in our place?
Mm-hmm.
Because Lutheranism is not indigenous. And it's not something that people automatically grow up with. And, is it? It's not something that people would get because they, saw the altar guild laying the linens on the altar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what is it about that tradition that might speak to a larger context or a larger culture?
Mm-hmm. Are you coming up with answers?
Well, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, yeah. But, there are answers that aren't really satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At this point, mm-hmm. they're kind of still open questions.
Yeah. In the American context, it's fascinating to me how the different traditions really influence each other. I mean, it's very partly, it's just sociologically true that denominational loyalty is much lower than it has ever been. Right? People don't understand necessarily what the distinctive traditions are about. When they move, don't always choose then to join another church of their same denomination. A lot of us have made pilgrimages through many denominations in the course of our lives. And there is a lot of mutual influence which can perhaps take away some of the distinctive things which each tradition has to offer. On the other hand, maybe there's an opportunity to experience what others offer. People who are not Lutheran who come to Holden Village probably get a different, gotten a slightly different slant on the meaning of Christian faith in a Lutheran context than you would get in another context.
What's interesting is that this sort of a humanizing of a revelation, mm-hmm. because all of those practices and the simple idea is the way human societies deal with anything. And that's why this traditions in medicine mm-hmm. and education, mm-hmm. they don't have the same particulars, but it's the way we maintain them. And yet, mm-hmm. and so you can see mm-hmm. it as a kind of developing organism in a way. But this one happens to be about, at least the central good is what you say, a revelation that doesn't come about that way.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of paradoxical and intriguing in a way. One might think that means that there are, that the source of change or the nature of the conflict in this particular one will not be entirely from within. I mean, if God acts in history, then further acts are possible. Or, I mean, it's a little bit parallel mm-hmm. to the scientists. I mean, what's happening in astronomy, say.
Mm-hmm.
Old things never before conceived.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's something intriguing about this balancing of tradition and the openness to the possibility of mm-hmm. revelation yet to be.
Yeah.
I think that's a really valid point, uh-huh. especially when you think about the fact that the more we talk, are we talking about what we're talking about, or is what we believe, you know, or as we discuss all these ideas, is it what God had in mind, or is it what we have? You know, do we develop our own systems and so forth to work because it works for us, and are we forgetting, you know, that is this what God had in mind? We talked a lot about that amongst ourselves the last week when we felt a lot of challenges, you know, this idea of world religion. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. maybe we could, I don't know if that's sort mm-hmm. of going the other direction, mm-hmm. but perhaps, you know, in dealing with the criticism of Christianity, if that is too narrow, do we need to expand it? Is this, you know, Christ coming into the world the be all and end all, or is, as we talked about in some sessions last week, where we want to look at Christianity as one religion mm-hmm. revolving around a central, you know, a theocentric type of, you know, a major power God, if you will, and Christianity is only one of these, you know. And then I think, then are we losing that very basic, you know, that's the way I refer to it, that very basic thing. I mean, if you're talking Christian tradition, you're talking about Jesus Christ. Is that the only thing that we have to maintain in order to talk about Christianity? And that's why all these other mm-hmm. things seem more surface to me.
Mm-hmm.
But now even that seems to be not, I don't want to talk about eroding away, but challenged in the sense that it makes, is it any different to be a Christian than to be, a Buddhist or a Hindu or whatever? I mean, is it absolutely necessary to keep that distinction?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to me that was always the bottom line, but in I think we've had critiques and challenges to even that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How many denominations are there in Christianity?
Oh, there's something like 35,000 in the United States.
Denominations.
Yeah.
Denominations.
Denominations. No, there are a lot. There are a lot. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Something like that.
4,500, I think, is what there are in the way of denominations.
Is that right?
There's 222,000 in the world.
It's, I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot.
What occurred to me is that if you went to each of these 2,200, 3,500, or however many there are, and said, what is essential in your Book of Confessions or whatever the equivalent is that makes you Christian. I don't think you get a lot of different answers. In some cases, there might be only one thing that they have in common. And in some cases, I don't know what you find.
No, that's, I think that's, you would get different answers, but the question is, and they might say, I mean, the ones over here might say, we don't talk to the ones over there, right? We don't recognize them as within. But I think that looking at them historically, you can see that they belong to a family which is involved in an argument, you know, a conversation that stretches through time and which has many, many different answers.
I hope I'm not mistaken, but you know, if you're talking about argument, I think perdition and traitor come from the same root word.
They might as well.
And that's very useful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Traitor.
Mm-hmm.
Say. How can one who thinks he or she is practicing the tradition be in fact a traitor to such? By practicing the tradition without any embracing of or access to the social embodiment that you know, the world is in and the church is in. And so, but also who's involved in this argument? You know, how far does the argument go? To what length is it extended? You know, sometimes the argument is just among theologians. And the people are told to say, well, accept what has been decided. You know, I'm saying let the argument continue. Let us all be involved in that. That seems to me that's what we do at Holden. A lot of arguing goes on and a lot of conflict that goes on within oneself as different assertions are made about one's belief, one's spirituality, and how do we argue around that in a manner that speaks this truth and love, which again is part of the tradition.
Right.
That's, you know, I'm supposed to be the village philosopher this week, so I'm hoping as we get into uncharted waters, and sometimes those waters get over our head rather quickly, that we can rise to the surface and say, what is the guide that can help us as we argue and as we make different assertions?
I would hope that that some of these concepts would help to say that you can't rule other people out of their claim to be authentically Christian, even when there are major differences which seem to unsettle the foundations, because that has happened in that's happened in every generation of Christian history, and is part of the ongoing life of the Christian community as it has been, as I'm sure it will continue to be.
I think you have a couple of different points. One is that back to the denomination, again, it seems to be the list of practices which divide them, although some of them think that I'm the basic theology. But then my other question is, sort of, and what makes a religion viable? And I'm thinking that I've read that some of the European countries particularly have state religions. It doesn't mean a thing to the people, and so they might be doing all the practices in the traditional way, but it has no relevance to people's lives. And so at what point does tradition really maintain its meaning versus just be a social something?
In general, in those places, the people are not practicing any longer. Okay, they're not. Maybe you could speak from Sweden. I mean, the
there is about in Sweden, it's about between 2% and 4%. But on the other hand, people need traditions. So most people baptize their children. Mm-hmm. Very many of them are confirmed in the Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. Even if they haven't been to church since their baptism, they have to go to church for a certain period to be confirmed. And then weddings are popular. Nearly all funerals mm-hmm. are taken care of by the church. Mm-hmm. It's nearly impossible to have another type of funeral. So mm-hmm. It's sort of strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
People have these religious needs, but they don't feel very comfortable going to church every Sunday. So. But then they are still sort of religion exists in the thinking and in the schools up to a very recent time. Religion was mm-hmm. it's still a subject, but now it should be objective. It was when I was a child. It was the Lutheran type. Mm-hmm. Christianity that mm-hmm. was
it was in the state school. Yes. In the state schools. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. A subject
yeah.
that you
had
to have.
Yeah. Well, I would see that situation in these terms as I understand it, as in a sense a withering of the range of practices that are really sustained. And so there's some of the practices are sustained, but not enough for a full-bodied Christian community which can correct itself and so on. I mean, there are probably some congregations where that's not the case. But
yes, it's not the whole truth, because the people who go to church, mm-hmm. they of course have very right. ordinary parishes, and mm-hmm. they
yeah.
couldn't see the difference between them and the ones here.
Right.
So.
Right. Right.
It's a complicated. Mm-hmm. It's not a very simple situation. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it will change because the state churches are sort of absurd in our times. So there is a continuing discussion about that. And it probably will end mm-hmm. by a separation between state mm-hmm. and church.
Mm-hmm. Well. I don't know if there's so many things that were open, the world religion question and others. I think that traditions can be transformed into something altogether new. You know, there that can happen. You know, they can take new directions. But I think that as far as Christianity goes, maybe we'll just close with this sense that it is something which is still being shaped, whose full history is not yet known, and in our generation, you know, holds much of that in its hands for good and for ill. I think that reverence for the past and the future should be part of that holding, but it is as much power as every other generation has exercised, and that will continue to be. So that will conclude.